This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is September 17th, 2020, and this is episode 207.
I'm Scott Lundebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, the results of the BC Green Leadership Contest, what the province's economic recovery plan will look like, and we look at politics all the way across the country to New Brunswick. Thank you to the 98 people who've contributed every month. You can support this podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. And Politicoast, as always, is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Well, to kick it off, Sonia's first in now. Sonia First in Now is the new leader of the BC Greens. She won, as I think most people largely expected her to, but it was much narrower than most people were predicting.
Yeah, there's no surprise that she won, but what's interesting is that Cam Brewer, who we had on a couple of weeks ago, surprisingly got 41% on the first ballot to Sonia First Now's 47%. Made a much stronger showing than anyone was really expecting, considering his late entry into the race.
Yeah, on the second ballot, which he managed to force, he pulled in 2,100 votes to Sonia First Now's 2,400 votes. So she won 53-47%. And if he had cleaned up Kim Darwin's votes, those 500 votes she got in the first round, he might have actually won it. But I think he only managed to take about half of them, and Darwin's votes split down the middle. But I think it's worth digging into, how did Cam Brewer do so well? Because as you mentioned, he only announced his candidacy on July 25th, 2 days before the candidate deadline, which gave him a little over a month to sign up supporters before the voting started. Essentially, the supporter deadline to sign up was September 2nd. First Now announced in January, Darwin in March. He doesn't, when we talked to him, he didn't have a political background, really. He hadn't been active in politics, and he takes on a sitting MLA. How did he do it, Cam? How did he do it, Scott?
And so I don't have any great insight into the inner workings of his campaign, but if I was to guess, he probably put together a fairly good team for that. And in addition to that, I don't think the BC Green Party is nearly as united as some people think it is, or I guess a better way to phrase that is that the Green Party has some pretty different visions about what it should be, and Sonia First Now is significantly more left orientation than the previous leader hasn't gone over uniformly.
There's kind of two factions within the Green Party, and it can be viewed a number of ways, but the most common is the more like eco-socialist, the left wing of it, and then there's a sort of eco-capitalist, I guess we could call them, or at least eco-centrists, people who would be at home in the BC Liberals at times, maybe at times in the BC NDP, but who think we need a much stronger environmental plan than either of those parties have put forward. Like you mentioned, that's where Andrew Weaver fits pretty well. I don't think Sonia First Now would qualify as a eco-socialist in the way some of the candidates for the federal Greens are running on, but she did run on a more progressive, a more left-wing platform with talk of the four-day week work week, most notably. I also wonder if First Now didn't run too much of a kind of coast-to-victory type of campaign, assuming it's in the bag. On the day before the announcement was pulled, on the day before the announcement was made of who won, I looked up what the ad spend for the different candidates was on Facebook, and Cam Brewer had spent $3,700 on Facebook ads to $682 by First Now and $345 for Darwin. That's not much money by any of them, frankly, when a single donor can give $1,500 to each of those candidates. Given they all had to do a lot of online outreach, the fact they were not spending much, and Brewer just managed to spend 5-10 times as much as his opponents, got his message out there more. Well, he's got this one side to the sort of establishment right scent of the party, with kind of, we talked about his support from Andrew Weaver. And then he was also willing to go for the votes more, maybe.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, definitely. Cut that. Yeah, I think you're right that Simon First Now is leading a fairly traditional Coast to Victory frontrunner campaign, which, yeah, she started off far enough ahead. That wasn't going to be an issue in this case, unlike some other recent leadership contenders who missed on an open net, so to speak.
It is nice to see someone.
But yeah,
it is nice to see. Pardon? It is nice to see someone who it gets first place on the first ballot, get first place on the second ballot, and not this like come from behind victory every time.
Yeah. So in that respect, he definitely, I think, worked hard to kind of reach out to more people than the First Now camp of, oh, we're the obvious choice, we're going to try and consolidate around that. So yeah, I think that helped his performance overall.
I think he also represented a different strategy of growth for the party. First Now represents the party in some ways as it is, with a very Vancouver Island riding, very sort of Vancouver Island focus. Cam Brewer coming from Metro Vancouver, maybe to many people looked like an opportunity to grow the party beyond their kind of beachhead on Vancouver Island and start to look at seats either in Metro Vancouver or perhaps the interior.
It is tough. The obvious spot for them to try and make gains is the South Island. That's where they've done. Metro Vancouver, there just aren't many races where they've even come in second tier. What, one or two in the interior?
Yeah, like Nelson.
So, yeah, it makes it hard to make the case that a Vancouver-centered leader who might not be able to win a seat in a general election would be the kind of electability candidate. On the other hand, there may be something for kind of that more centrist appealing strategy given the Liberals' weakness. And if you're a Cam Brewer, maybe you have a better chance of picking off disaffected Liberals, which there seem to be quite a few of these days who aren't that happy with the current leadership, than Sonia First Now trying to fight with the NDP for the progressive vote.
Yeah, that switches into what do these results ultimately mean? And I think you're totally right. The Cam Brewer direction would be to still try and steal votes from every party, whereas First Now, its clear target would be disaffected New Democrats voters who perhaps don't like the position on LNG or haven't been impressed enough with action on climate change.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, it seems to be a lot easier to get disaffected New Democrats than disaffected Liberals. Like, the Liberals will grumble and vote for the Liberals, whereas, I don't know, the NDP base seems a little less solid in
ways. If you believe the polls right now say the Liberals might be bottoming out in the mid-20s to low-30s, there might just not be that many Liberal votes to peel off.
Yeah, temperamentally more suited to go against the party, but we'll see.
What it definitely means is that First Now will be pursuing the platform that she talked about. When we talked to her on the podcast, I think she'd only released one or two bits of her policy. Her broader platform, which is still up on our website, I believe, talks about, like we said, the 4-day work week, more protections for workers, a green industrial strategy, environmental protections, working with First Nations, climate change, very typical green stuff in that regard, action on food security, inclusiveness, and a real focus on the overdose crisis. She talked about decriminalization, I'm assuming along the lines as Dr. Bonnie Henry has laid out in the past, and additional mental health supports out there. So really trying to find those areas where perhaps the NDP has been struggling to make gains. I won't say that they've been making mistakes on those files, but those are difficult files and ones where I think there is weakness on the record.
Yeah, those are definitely the files where I guess the inherent caution that comes from governing has maybe put them offside with their activist base. in a lot of ways, which, yeah, there's means some opportunity there.
It might also mean the NDP needs to bulk, needs to build up their left flank to protect from peeling, having too many votes peeled off in that direction. Whereas if Cam Brewer had won, it might be a more, oh, we're just fighting two liberal parties, so we can just be the competent ones who are in government. So you don't want to change governments in the middle of a pandemic kind of situation.
Yeah, it is funny how the local situation here is mirroring kind of the federal alignment of parties, except now the BC NDP is where the federal Liberals are being pulled out from the left, with the Greens saying, oh, you're not going far enough on a bunch of stuff.
Well, we'll have to see how First Now manages to capture the public attention, and how she does if we do end up in an election in the next few days, weeks, or at latest next year.
Oh, seems like a good spot to move on to our second segment, a $1.5 billion election platform. So today, the BC government put out their Stronger BC Recovery Plan, which isn't so much a recovery plan as an election platform in the guise of a government policy. So reading through the document, it lays out a bunch of their actions to address the COVID situation, both in the past and going forward. And the document itself spends at least as much time talking about how great a job they've done up to this point, all the things that they, the policies they put in place, using very much kind of the NDP-friendly framing throughout the whole thing. The whole thing really reads more like an election platform than a typical government press announcement or report.
I think it is worth acknowledging that this policy booklet, this announcement, does flow directly from the spending approved by the whole legislature unanimously back in that special session in March, where they said, here is the money we're going to throw at the pandemic. And at the bottom of it was $1.5 billion to be allocated later for recovery. And people went, what does that mean? And the NDP said, we'll tell you later. And this is them telling us. So in that sense, it is just government spending that has been approved by the legislature. And it's funding that will roll out regardless of whether we go into an election. As the premier described, it's gone from the hands of the politicians to the bureaucrats to already start rolling out many of these policies.
On the other hand, that does make the NDP's push for an unnecessary election even more crass and nakedly opportunistic, because this was money that got set aside when all the parties pulled together. They weren't playing politics back in March, and they all came together to actually, you know, address the crisis and get stuff done. And now the NDP is taking the goodwill that's emerged out of that from the, and the pull and bump that's come from that, and are using that as a, what's fairly obviously going to be the jumping off point for an election that they didn't have to call, but are trying to use the opportunity to their advantage.
I think it's worth digging into what's actually new in this document, in this announcement, because I think that hints that either there will be other stuff coming if there is a platform coming forward, or at least they referenced Budget 2021 will have additional measures, because there's, I think, a lot actually missing from here in terms of direct help for individuals. So there's four focus areas of Stronger BC: better healthcare, getting people back to work, helping BC businesses hire and grow, and stronger communities. The healthcare stuff has largely been previously announced in the last couple of weeks. There was a big announcement about hiring 7,000 new healthcare workers and 600 contact tracers, and this new hospital at home program as part of the way to help handle the second wave that we find ourselves in.
And that's actually pretty common throughout this, is there's a lot of stuff that isn't so much new, it's just being re-announced to inflate the number.
Yeah, similarly, I don't think there was much in getting people back to work that I saw that was new. There was some additional money for existing priorities like childcare and Clean BC, some short-term work and training funds. The stronger community stuff at the end was also largely re-announcements of the $1 billion of safe restart money for transit, the funding for schools. It's in the helping businesses hire and grow that I think there were some new measures announced. Chief among them being this $300 million small and medium business recovery grant, which is a hiring subsidy to encourage businesses that had to either lay off people or haven't been able to hire. Basically, if your small, medium business, nonprofit, charity has hired anyone in the last few months, the BC government wants to give you money. Or if you plan to hire someone by the end of the year, I believe you might be able to get this money as well, which on top of the federal wage subsidy feels like a pretty good way to make sure we are getting people in jobs.
Yeah, it go a fair ways, at least on the marginal jobs. Companies still aren't going to make hires, so they don't see a long-term potential for it, but it definitely helps on the margin by lowering the costs.
Yes.
Up front, and hiring is not cheap.
Yeah, either. Similarly, the government's adding a 15% tax credit on new payroll. So again, really trying to spur that additional hiring. And there'll be a temporary PST rebate for certain machinery and equipment for those businesses that were considering delaying expansions. Anyone who lived through the HST fights will know this is the key thing that was like the best reason for adopting the HST, is then businesses wouldn't be paying sales tax on the stuff they need to do business. And it's just the end consumer who would pay the sales tax.
Yeah, it would almost be simpler just to reintroduce the HST, but I'm guessing as high as they are in the polls, they're not really going to want to open that can of worms.
I'm hearing rumors and grumblings that Jason Kenney might do a PST in Alberta, but you know, maybe that's a only Nixon can go to China type situation. The other new announcement in this was $100 million for the tourism industry and a tourism task force. I think the industry had wanted a significantly larger amount of money than that. But given how much longer COVID's going to be around, I don't know what you can do for the tourism industry. Like, we keep extending the border closures, so we won't have American tourists. We don't really want to encourage people from other provinces to be traveling here. And we still want to limit a certain amount of travel within the province.
And fundamentally, 5 million British Columbians just aren't enough to keep the entire province's tourism industry going for any length of time. That's even assuming everyone has the money to do a bunch of tourism stuff in the middle of a recession. So best case scenario is you're really just trying to keep the industry on life support for a couple years.
And it's really tough. Anyone I know who's involved in tourism or entertainment has had a really tough go. Some people who are entertainers are starting to find work again, and things are starting to warm up as some physically distanced shows are starting to come around and people are figuring out how to take their shows online, but it's nowhere near the same as it was. So those are really tough industries, and there's not enough in here to support them, which is where I was hoping to see more on the, like, how are we supporting people who can't go right back to the jobs they were in? And there's a bit about retraining or training for new jobs, but not at the scale that it would take to shift entire industries. And that's where I'm almost wondering if additional money will be coming either maybe from the federal throne speech or from a platform to come.
Yeah, they have $20 million for short-term skills training for in-demand jobs, which there has to be a lot of in-demand jobs for that to really work. And $20 million isn't a huge amount. Same thing with the half million they have for health and human services targeted training. Just not a huge amount overall.
So, like, the healthcare stuff is a good chunk of this, and that is important. And I get why that was, and they did say that was announced early just to reassure people that as cases were going up, there was an effort being made to make sure we could handle it with additional healthcare workers and a plan there. Like I said, the hiring subsidies seem like they're targeted.
Yeah, a $300 million injection into the small business sector isn't a bad thing at all, and will probably help, but it's relative to the scale of the problem. Everything in here just isn't all that big.
But I guess we have to wait till budget 2021, because one thing Minister James referenced was that this is between budget spending, right? This is extraordinary spending and isn't the end of it. There will be more coming, and that budget will either be delivered under this current government or under a either larger NDP caucus, or maybe they'll blow their... Maybe it'll be a huge mistake, and maybe it'll be the Andrew Wilkinson budget or the Sonia Firstenau budget or some other combination of them. But maybe let's get into...
Yeah, on that front, I think it's... I don't want to say a mistake because they're right behind the polls, but definitely, I think, riskier than the NDP is assuming. Because I've heard nobody that isn't deeply enmeshed in NDP party politics. I mean, like, strong supporters, like, active people who work for the party show any kind of interest in an election at all. And it's crassly opportunistic. Everyone can see that. There's no real way around that narrative. And it's going to be tough to tell people that you can't do a whole bunch of things you want to do. We're barely keeping the school situation going. We're getting record levels of new COVID cases, but the real important thing right now is we have an election to strengthen John Horgan's position for the next few years.
I think one of the things that must... I don't disagree with any of that, but I think one of the things that must be going through the minds of the people closest to the, you know, premier and those making these decisions or who are set to make these decisions is that those concerns will definitely be voiced and loud for a week or two, but the question is, will they persist through the entire election, or will we all get over it in 2 or 3 weeks and then start focusing on the actual debate of who's going to win? And there'll be some begrudging, I'm sure, but I think the hope within the government must be that people will get over it, just accept that it's happening, vote in advance, vote by mail, do whatever they can to do it safely, and we'll go that way.
I mean, perhaps, but on the other hand, though, it's a case where, you know, up until now, the NDP's done a pretty good job of not seeming particularly partisan, or the grand chess masters who are just making moves for purely opportunistic political reasons. Even when they have, they've generally done a good job of casting it in broader positive framing that British Columbians have responded between negatively to positively to. And doing something really big like this risks upsetting that general feeling and resetting where British Columbians feel about John Horgan and the NDP government.
So I guess the question ultimately becomes, is this a case of 1975 where Dave Barrett calls a snap election hoping to secure a second NDP majority and it backfires as he'd pissed off enough union supporters that they didn't turn out and the Social Credit wins a narrow victory over them in the ultimate raw vote but manages to knock the NDP out for several decades? Or is this more like Jean Chrétien in 2000, who calls an election a year or two early? This was even before fixed election dates. So there was an election in 1997 federally, and so he didn't have to have one until 2002, but he called one in 2000 because the Canadian Alliance, I think, had just formed, and he's like in mock Stockwell Day till the end of time and easily cruised through to another majority. Or even, and we'll mention it in quick takes, the case of Blaine Higgs and the New Brunswick election, where they just managed to secure another majority And it's a bit too early to tell.
It's always too early to tell. You can never really know when you drop the writ for these. Another go-to example would be the election that Theresa May called to try and shore up an existing majority government and only to get beaten back to a minority and derail her whole project.
That one's really notable because Jeremy Corbyn's Labour started very far back in the polls and surged in that campaign.
He had an unlikable, fairly unpopular leader of the opposition.
Fair enough. I was going to say he's a different politician than Andrew Wilkinson, but actually, when you put it that way, they might be ideologically very different, but
temperamentally, yeah. Maybe not as much. Yeah, any early election is a risk, and particularly one during periods of nationalist societal stress, whether it's Brexit or COVID-19, things can go off the rails pretty quick. So it's a higher risk play than I think the movers and shakers in Victoria think it is. And more to the point, like, it's putting aside all the political calculus aspect of it, it's just maybe not a good idea in general. Today we had a record new number of cases. A month from now, the 160 a day we're having right now could be well over 1,000. Exponential growth doesn't really care about your partisan considerations, and you know, we're one or two super spreader events away from that. And it's just the case where, with everything else going on, maybe pulling all the ministers away from their portfolios to mostly focus on campaigning just isn't the wisest move purely from a governance point of view.
So the caretaker convention will make sure things proceed forward in largely the same way, but I think the opposition will actually get a little bit more input just in case they win, then they need to be briefed on things. So I'm a little less worried about how government functions during, but I think one thing,
it's not so much the whether or not you have a civil service doing stuff, it's having leadership take their eye off the ball. And the caretaker convention's fine, but like, there is no real substitute for having every smart person in Victoria focused on dealing with the current crisis rather than trying to flip seats in the suburbs of Vancouver.
Dr. Bonnie Henry will definitely still be focused on the pandemic. So that gives me at least some hope there. But one thing that is worth pointing out is the argument is that the NDP needs a majority to get through what they want, but I have not seen that borne out so far.
Sounds like
unless they're coming forward with a platform that is significantly more ambitious than what they've been acting on. And maybe that's in the works. But
even if they pull something more ambitious, that's going to be the case. Well, they'll probably get a bunch of Green support. Unless the ambitious thing is we're going to have not just one mega LNG project, but 20, like, they're going to get Green votes for it. So why call it now? That really seems like a rationalization that the NDP pundits are telling themselves.
Let's look a little bit at the substance of the smoke. Like, how do we know that this isn't just a bunch of smoke that's needless and beyond what people have told me off the record? The fact is we've now had, I think, two more ministers in the last 2 days announce they're not seeking re-election. In addition to Shane Simpson, I believe it was last week, Doug Donaldson earlier, Scott Fraser earlier, Carol James, much more previously due to health concerns. But this week, Michelle Mungall and Judy Darcy said they are not seeking re-election. So that's five cabinet ministers who aren't in a... I don't think there are any non-cabinet members, ministers of the NDP who aren't running again. But in addition to that, the NDP is on full candidate nomination. I've been trying to track all of the who's running where. And as far as I can tell, the NDP is the only party really running nomination races. The Liberals are starting to appoint some candidates, and I've not heard anything about the Greens other than they are looking for good candidates. they have a similar Become a Candidate for Us page that the BC Liberals have had for a while. Some of the most prominent races that have heated up in the last week, Oak Bay Gordon Head, which is Andrew Weaver's current riding, Murray Rankin, former federal NDP MP and justice critic, announced that he wants to run there. He's going to be challenging Oak Bay Councillor Michelle Kirby for that nomination.
That was actually a bit of a surprise for me. I was under the impression that Murray Rankin was done with politics.
Yeah, I don't know what convinced him to seek the nomination. He has come up a couple times in BC politics, being appointed to various task force commission type things from the government, but
yeah, and he was also appointed by the federal government to oversee intelligence oversight structure. I'm not quite sure which institution he got appointed to off the top of my head, but yeah, he had a bunch of roles there. And yeah, my impression, he seemed to be well situated in kind of the ex-politician world. So it's interesting to see him come back. If I was to guess, there was probably promises of a cabinet post made.
Up in Stikine today, Nathan Cullen announced he wants to seek the nomination there. If he's allowed to run, because it's unclear if he would qualify under the party's equity mandate, which says that if a current NDP MLA steps down, the new candidate nominee must be from an equity-seeking group, either a woman, a person of color, someone with a disability. I think LGBTQ plus also counts. And then another person has already put their name forward, Anita McPhee, who's a local Indigenous leader who's quite accomplished. And so it'll be interesting to see how that race shapes up. The party's in a bit of a sticky situation there, because if they say no to Nathan Cullen, per their policy, popular, charismatic, well-liked guy, and would do well as an MLA, but then if they say yes to him, it looks like they're not following their policy and favoring their guy over an Indigenous woman who wants to seek the nomination.
Let's go to the trade-offs inherent in such a formalized system. All parties try and get a diverse slate of candidates put together, but when you have such a rigid formal system like that, the issue is you can run into this very problem where you're stuck in a ride-in which you have a very solid candidate who would undoubtedly be not just a good MLA, but do well as a senior cabinet minister and one of the faces of the government, which would without a doubt help the party in the long run. And I don't know enough about Anita McPhee to really say one way or the other whether she would surpass that, but it definitely becomes a problem where you want to be able to have that flexibility and maybe try and offset it in a different nomination rather than trying to have to stick to such a rigid system.
Yeah, it's a continuous source of contention within the party and within the punditry. I think arguably it has successfully increased the diversity of the NDP's caucus. Now, whether that would have happened without it, people can argue both ways, but the NDP does have a very diverse caucus, and that makes our legislature more diverse, which is, I think, an overall positive for our politics. The thing with Cullen is he might have been able to just run in Skeena, which I believe he doesn't live in. I think he actually does live in Stikine, but if he ran in Skeena next door and challenged Ellis Ross for that seat, then everyone could be happy.
Yeah, it might be a little more of a difficult pickup. But yeah, also, like, the institutions that have these very formalized systems are also probably the ones that need it the least. And the NDP being what it is, I don't doubt that the membership and the people in charge of selecting candidates wouldn't already try very hard to get a diverse slate. So maybe not. It may be just another layer of complication where it doesn't have to be. And if any place needs those sorts of explicit policies, is probably not the ones that are so culturally and ideologically focused already on achieving those outcomes.
And eventually it will void itself. Like, at some point, they will have achieved diversity proportionate to the population. And there is
Does it actually have a sunset clause?
I don't know.
once they reach a representative cross-section of the province, it...
I'd have to go back and look at it to figure that out. But there is also the famous Ruth Bader Ginsburg approach, which is how many women on the Supreme Court of the United States is enough? And she says 9, because we've had centuries of 9 men on the court. So let's have some time with some all women courts. And I don't know if that argument will fly, but I like it. I find it amusing. But let's get to the final race that I flagged. And there's lots more that are interesting and shaping up. But in Vancouver Hastings, Shane Simpson's seat, which is a pretty safe NDP seat, we're seeing Nikki Sharma, longtime Vancouver politician and active with, I believe, Vision Vancouver, running against the party's, I believe she's executive director, Raj Sahota, or former. Sahota's been very deeply involved for the party for quite a while, but both have fairly high profiles, and it'll be interesting to see who's victorious out of that sort of.
Yeah, that's one of those seats that's a guaranteed win. Whoever gets the nomination is going to be an MLA. And we know it because it's one of the two seats that held on during the blowout of 2001. The other being my riding, which I'm not necessarily happy about and wish we'd gotten electoral reform, so my vote would actually matter. But yeah, there's a very strong incentive to try and get a Vancouver Hastings or Vancouver Mount Pleasant nomination if you are a new Democrat.
Oh, electoral reform, something we will probably only see in the Greens platform, unless the others talk about a citizens assembly, because I remember Wilkinson being sympathetic to that, at least during the debates. But after the results of that referendum, I don't know if the NDP or Liberals will want to touch electoral reform for quite a while, sadly.
I don't think the Liberals will, just because they came out against it so hard. And there's the assumption among a lot of rank and file Liberals that electoral reform would doom the party to perpetual minority status, even though they have a much better track record of winning the popular vote and overall, not just pluralities, but outright majorities of the vote in the past. I don't think it would be as bad as the Liberal partisans think it would be, but they definitely have convinced themselves otherwise that they're not going to touch it for, oh, I don't know, whenever the next time they come out on the losing side of first past the post.
We need another 1996 election where the NDP wins the seats, but not the popular vote.
Yeah, we get another one of those. The Liberals will take another look at it, but until that happens, they're not going to.
And my other favorite headline from the week was that Andrew Weaver, I think it was earlier today, said that an election call wouldn't violate the confidence and supply agreement. Just stick it in his caucus colleagues again. I don't really get the point of his comments anymore.
I don't think there's an explicit statement that there wouldn't be an election.
So the confidence and supply agreement actually starts off by saying the agreement between them is effective from 2017 for 4 years or until the next fixed election date. And there's no, unless the government decides they want to call an election.
Yeah, it's definitely against the spirit of the confidence and supply agreement.
But that document was never legally binding anyway. So I guess here we are.
So yeah, you're right. It's not legally binding, but it's definitely against the spirit of it. But there's no way to really hold them accountable to that. And there's no court that would touch this at all. So yeah, it is what it is. I don't know why Weaver said that other than to, I don't know, get headlines, stir the pot a bit.
Nevertheless, unless something changes in the premier's mood in the next, I think it's 48 hours. I think they're having a core caucus leadership party meeting either today or tomorrow to really hash out whether we're doing this. I think we're going to see an election call by next week. And hey, maybe I'll be wrong, but
I hope you are. I like talking about elections and thinking about politics, but honestly, this really just feels like one more damn thing this year that I don't want to have to deal with. And it just feels potentially exhausting. So I don't know. I hope the NDP come to their senses and don't proceed with an election and just decide to ride it out the full 4 years and just not subject BC to this.
At very least,
and I'm guessing probably not.
At very least, it would be a nice distraction from the US election, which I do not want to pay attention to.
I am not sure about that at all. And that is because there is nothing Canadian politicians like more than trying to import US political cleavages into Canada and to try and exploit them. Like guns and abortion. Like nobody is seriously proposing adopting US positions on either of those, but they get dragged up every federal election because it's good politics for mostly the Liberals in that case, sometimes the NDP too. Like trying to do a Canadian election while there's a US one going on, you're just going to blur the lines too much in a way that I don't think is helpful. And honestly, I think Canadian politics and BC politics would just be a lot healthier if there was just a giant bear firewall or whatever along the border that just stopped the news coming in for a while. Completely impractical. No way that would be legally or just policy-wise a good idea, but it would certainly make Canadian politics healthier, I think.
At very least, I'm glad that the BC Liberals haven't fallen down the populist path that a lot of other center-wing parties have. And so we at least have that going for now. Hopefully that stays, because I appreciate that. Let's jump into quick takes, though, to close off today's show. Turning over to federal politics, the election speculation there seems to be a little less in the air as Trudeau's tone has shifted a bit more towards consultation in the lead up to next week's throne speech. And even Jagmeet Singh, I believe, was talking about how it's the budget that actually he's more interested in looking at than the throne speech. And so it sounds like this throne speech will ultimately go through pretty easily. Even Aaron O'Toole, I think, was starting to put dampers on them. I don't want to force an election if I don't have to kind of situation.
Yeah, it's almost certain to pass. Not only because the NDP is not in a great position to run a campaign, but also nobody else really wants to do one right now. Every party except maybe the Bloc has a reason not to. And you're not going to get a situation where every conservative comes out and votes for it, but I could definitely see a situation where there's enough absences on the conservative benches that it's guaranteed to pass.
With that speech coming up on Wednesday, is there anything you'll be looking for? Trudeau's and the Liberals have hinted at lots and lots of goodies coming, a transformation of society. It's been a little light on specifics.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about the big push for kind of a green remaking of the economy, but that got walked back within the last week.
That was incredible. So just for the context of that, I was liking the talk of the move towards a greener economy, but then there was reports that some within the Liberal caucus, I think, didn't want to be seen to take advantage of this crisis for that. And we had the episode with Seth Klein where it's pretty clear, even if you don't agree with his prescription and his cure, that we are in a climate crisis. That one is still ongoing. And it would be nice to see someone take it seriously.
Yeah. Like even putting aside the climate crisis, like interest rates are super low right now. We need a bunch of infrastructure investment anyway in a lot of this stuff. And hell, just the air pollution alone, like the particulate pollution, which is probably worth spending tens of billions of dollars addressing just right away. So, I mean, you might as well do something big. There hasn't been enough thinking about long-term infrastructure investments in the economic recovery anyway, so you might as well do it. It's as good a time as any. You're going to be tough to borrow at this optimal interest rate environment again for a long time. So, let me just go for it. It's definitely a better idea, I think, than trying to rush a universal basic income in, which people can go back and listen to our episode with Lindsay Tedds a couple months ago on that. But that is just a super complicated policy problem that is not well suited to figuring things out and unlike infrastructure, which if done right can pay for itself, it's a lot harder to make the case for in with a universal basic income. And also, you don't want to just be borrowing to fund that, because that's not sustainable either. So given the two, I'd rather see the green investments.
Given like the wind down of CERB, I can see the value in maybe not a fully universal, but some kind of guaranteed income support. The federal government's been talking about revamping EI, and they've been hinting at a little bit about what that will look like. And EI is such a bad system that I am hopeful that we'll see something good in there. There's been a lot of talk as well, and the Liberals have talked a long time about support for childcare and pharmacare and these kind of big, or expanding our existing healthcare programs, which will ultimately just result be cutting checks to the provinces. But that's what the federal government is really good at sometimes. And so those are a little bit easier to roll out. And hopefully we can see those. Maybe he'll come back with electoral reform. Maybe he'll have changed his heart on that. I doubt it, but it would be nice.
There is zero chance that's going to happen.
We'll see which of those come true and which are just vaguely hinted at on Wednesday, and we'll talk about that next week.
The flip side of green infrastructure investments are pipelines, and Energy East is back in the news again, as Aaron O'Toole made a fairly definitive statement after talking with the Premier of Quebec, Francois Legault, that Energy East is definitively off the table.
The pipeline that no one was going to build, that Quebec was going to fight like hell to stop, and really seemed dead, is dead.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that's newsworthy about this, or at least the interesting thing about it, isn't that Energy East is now less likely to get built because it wasn't going to get built anyway, but how the Conservatives are positioning themselves. Andrew Scheer, for whatever reason, raised Energy East a few times during his time as leader, and it only hurt the party in Quebec. They've already pretty much won every vote they possibly can in Western Canada, or the Prairie provinces. They're not going to run at the store anymore. And it doesn't matter. They can afford to lose 10 points across the prairies and still sweep the region. But with it, the Conservatives really need to make gains here in Eastern Canada, and taking Energy East off the table is something that'll at least not hurt them there, maybe help them a bit. So what it really says to me is that O'Toole's learned the mistakes from his predecessor and isn't going to repeat them, isn't as much shrewder about how he approaches a lot of these issues, and as a result, I think has a much better shot at forming government than Andrew Scheer ever did.
Yeah, it seems like he was making a hard play for Quebec this week. He also talked about Bill 21, the laïcité, quote-unquote secularism law. Aaron O'Toole said in English, I guess, that he didn't like the law, but as a government, he would respect the provincial autonomy to pass such a thing. And I think he was even a little bit more supportive in the language when he talked about in French, saying how much he values secularism and things like that. He also even supported a Bill 101 expansion, and that's Quebec's very controversial French language law that has been one of the few uses of the notwithstanding clause, as Quebec wants to preserve and protect the French language and keep English out of the province. Both controversial things outside of Quebec, but largely popular in Quebec, especially with, I think, voters who would be more open to going to the Conservatives. So,
yeah, and this fundamentally doesn't put them in much of a different position than the Liberals in Quebec. So in that front, I think it really just removed another potential weakness for them in Quebec, which is once again probably good political strategy on O'Toole's part.
The only other thing I wanted to mention with regard to O'Toole and Quebec is that apparently the Conservative caucus had an exposure to COVID, and so did the Bloc caucus including Yves Francois Blanchet's wife. And so a lot of them are in isolation right now and working from home or wherever. I hope they all get better or don't fully contract, come down with symptoms, but shows you how the virus really is getting everywhere. And maybe the conservative call to reconvene parliament fully is not the wisest move.
I should just do it in the lawn in front of the parliament buildings. Problem solved.
It'll be great in February. They can do it on Rideau Canal and skate up and down.
Bundle up.
Moving a little bit further east.
If anything, it should cut the speeches short.
Oh, moving a bit further east to New Brunswick. They had an election this week as Premier Blaine Higgs sought to turn their very unstable minority government hung legislature into a majority government, and his gambit paid off, which probably only helps fuel the ambition and almost, let's say, arrogance of the people behind the scenes in the BC NDP.
I was really hoping that the incumbents in New Brunswick would lose entirely for that reason. So John Horgan and the team in his office would get cold feet about the idea. But alas, that did not happen. And the PC party in New Brunswick's fairly decisive win. The leader of the opposition, Kevin Vickers, actually lost his seat. So yeah, overall a good night for the New Brunswick
PCs. Yeah, they picked up a few percentage in the popular vote. I think some of the polls on the night before elections were almost even, that it could go either way. But the PCs got a 5-point lead, 39 to 34 over the Liberals, which translated into quite a swing in seats. So the PCs have 27 seats now, the Liberals 17. The Greens held on to their 3 seats, and I think they picked up a few votes. And the People's Alliance, which is a very unique to New Brunswick, so I won't even talk about it, party, they lost a seat. But yeah, a new stable Blaine Higgs progressive conservative government in New Brunswick, which I guess only encourages our own government to consider their potential fortunes.
Yeah, if there's something to wave them off, it's not going to be New Brunswick.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.